All right, we are underway. We're underway, and we're at session 20, lesson 4, page 19 of your outline. So let's do a little bit of a review to look over where we were last week. Last week, Yeshua had returned to Capernaum, Capernaum, his new headquarters. And there he caused quite a stir with his teachings. And because of all the publicity around him, we learned that rabbis were coming out of Galilee and rabbis were coming out of Judea and Jerusalem up to Capernaum to check him out and find out what was going on. There weren't a lot of rabbis in Galilee because Galilee was not a center of rabbinic Judaism. So they're all coming to investigate who this guy is and what he's up to. And one of those rabbis, undoubtedly, was Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. I suggest that if you want to read about him in detail, you can read about him in First Century Judaism in Crisis. He is the rabbi who was a Pharisaic missionary to Galilee to bring the Galileans to the Torah. And he was there for 18 years, and he only judged two cases. So he was very upset with Galilee after he left after 18 years and cursed the area. Well, he survived the destruction of the temple in AD 30. He moved to Yavna, he started a yeshiva, and he restructured rabbinic Judaism. He restructured Judaism from a religion that needed temple and sacrifice, biblical Judaism, into a religion, the religion of the rabbis today. So he's the guy that really started modern rabbinic Judaism. And we read about how he was totally unsure of his relationship with God when he died. A very sad story. Anyway, he was there among the crowd, and the incident that we looked at centered around Peter's home when some friends of a paralytic tried to bring this paralytic into Peter's home for healing. And there were so many people around the door, they couldn't get in, so they went up the stairs there, up on the roof, and then they lowered the paralytic down in front of Jesus. Now, Jesus did not heal the man directly, but he said, "Your sins are forgiven," because he knew that would raise the issue that it would raise. And the Pharisees in the room, probably including Yochanan ben Zakkai, were thinking in their minds, "How can he do this? He blasphemes. Only God can forgive sin." And Yeshua let them know that he was reading their minds by telling them what they were thinking, and then challenged them with the comment, "What is easier to do? To say your sins are forgiven, or to say take up your bed and walk?" And of course, it's much harder to say take up your bed and walk because that requires proof. It has to happen. And he said, "In order to prove to you that I have authority to forgive sins, and therefore I am God in the flesh," he says to the man, "Take up your bed and walk." The guy is healed instantly and goes out rejoicing. And the crowd, of course, is rejoicing as well. Well, this is the first stage of the investigation by the Sanhedrin, the stage of observation. They can't say anything. They didn't say anything. But they report back to the Sanhedrin, this is a significant messianic movement. And so from now on, we will see Pharisees and representatives of the Sanhedrin there dogging Jesus with questions. They enter stage two of the Sanhedrin's investigation, the stage of interrogation. They'll be asking who, what, when, why, what's your authority, things like that. So be alert to that as that stage of the investigation begins. So, now, we want to start on page 19. And our school is called the School of Biblical and Jewish Studies. And the reason we call it the School of Biblical and Jewish Studies is because we teach the Scripture from a Jewish perspective, and then we insert tidbits from Jewish culture into our studies so you'll understand the culture in which Jesus was dealing with. And so this class is going to introduce you to rabbinic literature. Basically, we're going to have a heavy emphasis on the Mishnah and the Talmud, and hopefully clear up any confusion in some minds, make it very clear what exactly these two pieces of literature are and where did they come from. And then we'll also get a chance to see how they interact with Yeshua as well. So we're at the top of page 19. The word is definitions there. And we want to ask the question, what is the Mishnah? because the Mishnah is going to be the main area of conflict between Jesus and the religious leaders, the Mishnah. Now, the Mishnah is mentioned in the New Testament many times, but it's mentioned under the title the Traditions of the Fathers, or the Traditions of the Elders, or simply just the Traditions. That is a reference to the Mishnah. That's its title. That's its title in the New Testament. It's the oral law. Now, it was in development at this time, but not quite completed. Not quite completed. So let's start with its development. How did the Mishnah develop? Well, I have a chart on your outline, and we'll work through this chart and explain the details of it. The chart is called The History of Jewish Oral Traditions. And, of course, the Jewish oral traditions need a foundation. So the foundation was laid in approximately 1440 BC, right around that time period, with Moses, because that's when the Mosaic Law was given by God. That is the written law. That is the written law given by God to Moses on Mount Sinai. So that's the foundation of our Jewish oral traditions. Question?
Is that the Ten Commandments?
Yes, that's the Mosaic Law, the Ten Commandments, correct. All right, now, around 400 BC to around 30 BC, a school of teachers came into existence we call the Soferim. The word Sofer, which is singular, means scribe. Soferim is plural. Now, Ezra was the leader of this school, and you read about Ezra in the book of Ezra. Now, at the beginning, they had a very, very honorable intent. You see, Ezra and the other leaders of the community recognized that the reason for the Babylonian captivity was violation of the Mosaic Law, primarily idolatry. We broke the Mosaic Law. God punished us with the 70-year Babylonian captivity. But now we're back in the land. And so the Sofrim wanted to make sure that never happened again. So the Sofrim expounded the law, and there's 613 laws in the Mosaic commandments, 613 commandments in the Mosaic Law. So they expounded all 613 commandments to make each law very, very clear so that it would not be broken again. If they felt that if everyone understood what the commandment was clearly in their mind, that they wouldn't break it. Well, as time passed, the Sofrim then began to pass other laws. They didn't just expound on the laws of the Mosaic Covenant. They began to pass their own laws. So over the next 100 years, these extra laws were developed, and they were intended to be a fence protecting the 613 Mosaic laws. The idea here was that if you were going to break a law, you might run into the fence and you might break through the fence, but the Mosaic Law would be protected. You know, the fence would keep you from breaking the Mosaic Law. It was an outer guardian. That was their idea. Now, these laws were developed using what's known as pill-pull reasoning, P-I-L-P-U-L, pill-pull reasoning, or rabbinic reasoning. And you'll get some examples of that tonight. Basically, it's reasoning that's based on very detailed quibbling over details. Every detail has to be worked over to its maximum. Quibbling. Oh, pill-pull? P-I-L-P-U-L. Rabbinic reasoning or pill-pull reasoning. So every detail had to be sent through the ringer so that we could anticipate any possible violation of the law and make sure that was covered. We're going to cover every possible situation we could think of. Therefore, we'll have this strong, very detailed fence that nobody can get through. We won't break the Mosaic Law. We won't go into exile again. That was the thinking. Did it work?
No.
No. Didn't work. We went into exile again between the years 70 and 135 AD. The temple was destroyed. And if it had worked, I wouldn't be here. There'd be no Jewish people in the United States. We'd all be in Israel. But it didn't work. It didn't work. Thank you. All right, so again, the school of the Sofrim extends from Ezra, who we know about in the Bible, to Rabbi Hillel. So around 400 B.C. to about 30 B.C. Now, they operated on a very important principle. Right-hand column there. A sofer can disagree with another sofer, but he could not disagree with the Mosaic Law. God gave the Mosaic Law. You can't mess with that. That's holy. It's divine. But you can't argue with the scribes. You can argue with them. All right, that was the first school. Starting around 30 B.C. to 220 A.D., the school of the Sofrim was succeeded by a second school, the school of the Tanaim. Tana, singular, Tanaim, plural. Tana means repeater, or teachers who repeated the legal regulations. Now, these rabbis added to the work of the Soferim. And they also worked on a very important principle on the right-hand column. A Tana can disagree with a Tana, but not with a Sofer. All right, if you're working on that principle, what happens to the conclusions of the Soferim? They become sacrosanct. They become divine law. They have to be obeyed. You can't argue with the Sofer anymore. All right? It's set in concrete. So now the work of the Soferim is mandatory to be obeyed. Now, we do have a very famous biblical fellow who is one of the Tanaim, and that's Paul. From approximately 30 to 67 A.D., we have the time frame of Jesus and Paul. Shaul, Rabbi Shaul, was his Jewish name. Rabbi Saul. He had an alternate Greek name of Paul, a Gentile name, kind of typical in Jewish systems, like I have two names myself. Now, Paul was a Tana, and we learn that in Galatians 1:14. Now, this is the NASB translation, and it reads, "I was advancing in Judaism beyond many of my contemporaries among my countrymen, being more extremely zealous for my ancestral traditions." And the key word there is the word advancing. What does that word mean? Well, a very clear explanation is given in the King James Version Bible commentary. Literally, the word is the Greek word prokopto, which means to cut forward, hence to blaze a trail or to cut a pioneer path. So Paul said that he was advancing, he was pushing forward, he was outstripping all others in power and prestige. So Paul was advancing in Judaism, and he was a trailblazer in Judaism, and that's what the Tanaim called themselves. They called themselves trailblazers. So that was Paul, advancing in rabbinic Judaism at the very best of his ability. Now, the work of the Soferim and the work of the Tanaim produced a work we know today as the Mishnah, the traditions of the fathers, the traditions of the elders, the oral law, the oral law. Now, the Tanaim needed validation for all these additional laws that they had written up. So they developed the position, they developed the reasoning that on Mount Sinai, God gave two laws to Moses. He gave us the written law, and he gave us the oral law. So let me show you that reasoning. See, the oral law was then orally passed down. Let me quote the Mishnah itself. Mishnah Maaseh Avot, chapter 1, Mishnah 1. Moses received the oral Torah at Sinai and transmitted it to Joshua, and Joshua to the elders, and the elders to the prophets, and the prophets to the men of the great synagogue. So the men of the great synagogue are the Soferim. So the point, God gave us the oral law too. Now how did they justify that? Basically, the thinking goes like this. This is the way the justification goes. the written law doesn't give us all the details. For example, how do you sacrifice an animal? Well, do you club it to death? Do you stab it with a spear? Do you slit its throat? Do you strangle it? Do you starve it to death? How do you sacrifice an animal? We don't know. God didn't tell us in the Mosaic Law. But we know how to do it. So God must have given the details orally to Moses. We know how to do it from tradition. So God must have given those details on how to slit a cow's throat to Moses up on Mount Sinai, and he would pass it down to the men of the great synagogue. So the point is, God gave the oral law on Mount Sinai as well. However, you guys, there is absolutely no evidence in the Bible of any traditional or oral law in the Old Testament. Absolutely zip. This is a rabbinic construct in order to give authority to the oral traditions. So the result of saying that God gave us the oral law too is that now the Mishnah becomes equal to the Mosaic Law. Now the Mishnah is obligatory and has to be obeyed as well. Got it? Make sense? Okay. Well, let's just take one more step. After the Tanaim, from about 220 AD to 500 AD, another school developed known as the school of the Amoraim. Amora is singular. Now, that's Aramaic for explainer or interpreter or spokesman. And all these terms basically mean these guys were your teachers. Now, they developed a commentary on the Mishnah known as the Gemara. Known as the Gemara, a commentary on the Mishnah. And they operated on a very important principle. Can you guess what the principle was? Yeah, you can read it there. An Amora can disagree with an Amora, but not with a Tana. Not with a Tana. So, what happens to the work of the Tanaim? Ah, it's suddenly, divine authority. Okay, now, so the Gemara is the work of the Amoraim. So you've got the work of the Sofrim and the Tanaim, creating the Mishnah or the Oral Law, and then you have the Mishnah plus the Gemara equals the Talmud, Okay, does that make sense? All right. That's where the Talmud came from. That's so important today. Now, here is a picture of a Talmud. And you can see it is an encyclopedia size volume. You know, my English copy of the Mishnah is about that thick. It's as thick as your Bible. But the rabbis went to town to dig out every possible violation of the Bible and the Mishnah in the Talmud. And so the Talmud goes on for pages and pages and pages for every oral law there is. And so that's why it's a encyclopedia size work. Here is a copy, a page of a Talmud. On the right-hand column, you can see, or the right-hand side, you can see the Talmudic, the Mishnah and the Gemara in the center there. The Mishnah and the Gemara are in the center, and surrounding them, separated by the little border, are commentaries. Then over on the left-hand side, you see an English commentary on this particular Talmud. So this one is designed for an English reading audience. So that's basically what the Talmud looks like. So the Amoraim then, from about AD 220 to about AD 500, and it's still going on. I'm not going to go any further than this, but it hasn't stopped over the last 2,000 years. The rabbis are still busy dealing with the law. All righty. Now, the result. I didn't give you much room to write all that down because we're now on page 19, toward the middle of the page, the result. Now, during Jesus' day, only the Mishnah existed. Only the Mishnah. It was almost fully developed by then. And again, this is the battleground between Jesus and the authorities. It's the authority of the Mishnah. Is it obligatory or not? That's the issue. We will see exactly how Jesus deals with it as we go through the text. So this is very, very, very critical to our understanding of what is going on in the New Testament. Okay, does that make sense? Believe me, it is. You know, I may have twisted your mind into a pretzel right now, but it'll all settle down. It'll all get straightened out over the weeks to come. All right? It'll all make sense, I hope. Okay, any questions? All right, Cindy?
The Sofra plus the Tannin equals the Mishnah.
Correct. That, their work. Their work equals the oral law, yes. Equals the Talmud, yes. Yeah. Okay? All right, that's where this literature come on. And remember, the Mishnah is the oral law. The Gemara is the commentary on the oral law. And only the Mishnah existed in Jesus' day. All right, at the bottom of page 19, you have a definition of the Mishnah to take with you and to think about and to read in your spare time. Page 20, I have an article on the Talmud for you. So it goes into a little more detail regarding this very famous bit of rabbinic literature. Then on page 21, you have one excerpt from the Mishnah. It's from Shabbat 51b. And this is what you would find if you opened up a page of the Talmud to Shabbat 51b. You would see the term Mishnah. And then below it, Gemara. So the Mishnah is the oral law. Of course, it's now written down because it got written down around 500 AD. So let's see what this particular Mishnah says. It says, wherewith may an animal go out on the Sabbath, and wherewith may it not go out? So what can an animal carry on the Sabbath? If your animal carries something other than this, you're liable for a sin offering. So what can your animal carry? A camel may go forth with a bit, a dromedary, that's a female camel, I believe, with its nose ring, a Libyan ass with a halter, a horse with its chain, and all chain-wearing animals may go out with their chains and be led by their chains, and the water of lustration may be sprinkled upon them, and they may be immersed in their place. Okay, that's the oral law. Then comes the commentary, the Gemara. So the rabbis begin to ask questions. What is meant by a dromedary with its nose ring, said Rabbah ben Bar Hana, a white female camel with an iron nose ring. That's what we're talking about. Then they go through the next three paragraphs, asking questions, trying to find out and quibble about every detail in this Mishnah so that they can be ready in case it's broken. And notice at the bottom of the article I wrote, etc., 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 because this Gemara goes on for pages.
All right?
No, about this Mishnah. About this Mishnah and all that's contained in that Mishnah. I hope that didn't come. I hope that wasn't picked up by the camera, Roger. He said... He was concerned about this comment about the dromedary because he didn't think they got over the hump. Yeah. Everybody boo. All right. All right, so there's an example, just a sample from the Mishnah and the Talmud. All right, bottom of page 21, we have an article on the scribes, a more detailed article that goes over to page 22. As well, and then we come to page 23, and another little introduction for you, an introduction to the traditional Shabbat laws. This comes from my Art Scroll Mishnah commentary by Rabbi Ezekiel Danziger. So let's read this together. Start with the first paragraph to there and read along with me. He does a great job of explaining it. No. Just read along silently. The Torah places two obligations upon a person with regard to the Sabbath. To remember the Sabbath day, which is fulfilled by the recitation of the prayer and the Kiddush. That's a prayer and a sip of wine that's taken. And to refrain from performing any labor. So there's only two commands given in the Mosaic Law regarding the Sabbath. Remember it, and don't perform any labor. With the exception of the prohibition of kindling a fire, though, the Torah does not explicitly state what constitutes labor We don't know what it is. Ay, 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 ay. What are we going to do? We can break it. How are we going to figure out what labor is? Well, here's how they did it. Here's how they did it. However, the Torah places the section describing the construction of the Mishkan, the tabernacle, with a repetition of the prohibition against performing labor on Shabbat. From this juxtaposition, the sages derived that the labors prohibited on the Sabbath are those which were necessary for the construction of the Mishkan and the preparation of its components. The Mishnah in 7:2 lists these labors and gives their total as 39. But notice the final paragraph. The formulation of these 39 labors is not intended as a ban on 39 specific acts of labor, but rather a ban on 39 categories of labor. They are therefore known as avot melachot, primary labors, literally fathers of labors. Activities whose prohibition is derived from one of these 39 are known as toledot, or secondary or descendant labors. And then I've listed the 39 categories there for you. Sowing, plowing, reaping, gathering, threshing, on and on and on and on, right down to number 39 at the end, transferring from domain to domain. Now we will remember that one on transferring from domain to domain, because we're going to put it in action here in just a little bit. Okay? Any question on that so far?
What's number 18?
Number 18, setting of two heddles. That has to do with you have a loom with what's called when you have a loom, you weaving. Yes, weaving. When you weave cloth, the heddle, I believe, is the thing that goes back and forth between the strands. Well, that's a shuttle. I don't know. The heddle, I don't know exactly what that is. But it has something to do with weaving.
Don't set it.
Whatever it is, don't set it. Yeah, okay. All righty. Okay, question. 29, tracing lines you can't write on Shabbat. If you go into an Orthodox synagogue, don't pull out your pencil and take notes. Forbidden. You'll get hammered. If you write notes, take notes on the rabbi's sermon. You can't write. Tracing lines. No, it's illegal. You're liable for a sin offering. So you can't write out a check either. All right. Okay. I'm going to let you guys take your break. So listen for the shofar in 15 minutes, and we'll come back and we'll begin to put this into action. All right, we're back underway again. Now we're going to pick this up. We're going to pick this up on page 24 of your outline. Now this is section 56. And we've now outlined the battleground for you. And this is where the conflict is. The Messiah's authority over tradition, over the Mishnah. This is the battleground. Very important battleground. So, top of page 24, the challenge to Yeshua, the challenge to Jesus. We pick up section 56 on page 56 of your harmony. And Matthew, Mark, and Luke cover this. So we'll start in the center column with Mark chapter 2, verse 18. Mark chapter 2, verse 18. Everybody get there okay? All right. And John's disciples and the Pharisees were fasting, and they came and said to him, "Why do John's disciples and the disciples of the Pharisees fast, but your disciples do not fast?" So there's an important issue in the Pharisees' mind. Jesus is not fasting. Now, the Pharisees set aside 2 days a week for fasting. Their fast days were Monday and Thursday. So if you were a good Jew, you fasted on those 2 days during the week. But Jesus is not doing that. He's not following rabbinic Judaism, and so he is challenged. So now we need to go to the Luke account for his response in verses 34 and 35. So we're in the right-hand column. on very bottom corner of page 56, verse 34. And Jesus said to them, "You cannot make the attendants of the bridegroom fast while the bridegroom is with them, can you? But the days will come when the bridegroom is taken away from them, then they will fast in those days." So Jesus responds with three examples and then a comment, a response. So example number one that he brings up is a wedding. You know, at a wedding, you don't fast. You feast. It's a joyful time. You know, the bridegroom is present. So it's not appropriate to fast then. It's appropriate to have a good time. After he leaves, after the bridegroom departs, hey, then you can fast, but not during the wedding, okay? So it's not an appropriate time to fast right now, is his first point. It's not appropriate to fast right now. Example number two is the repairing of a garment in verse 36. And he was also telling them a parable. No one tears a piece from a new garment and puts it on an old garment. Otherwise, he will both tear the new, and the piece from the new will not match the old. So here's his second example. You don't put a new patch on an old garment. Now, this is before sanferizing. This is before pre-shrunk cloth, right? Or in our day, pre-torn up jeans and, you know, pre-worn out clothes. Okay, but if you put a new patch on an old piece of cloth, that new patch would shrink and it would pull the garment together, and you could very easily make the tear worse than it was before. So his point is that he did not come to patch up Pharisaic Judaism. So it's not appropriate to fast at this time, and he didn't come to patch up Pharisaic Judaism. Example number three, wine in verses 37 and 38. And no one puts new wine into old wineskins. Otherwise, the new wine will burst the skins and it will be spilled out, and the skins will be ruined. But new wine must be put into fresh wineskins. Now, when you produced wine in those days, you took a new wineskin, soft and flexible, and you poured the grape juice into it, and you sealed it up, and it began to ferment. Now, as it fermented, it leaves off gases. And these gases would then be collected in the wineskin, and they will stretch it and stretch it and stretch it till it's finally stretched to its maximum. But then you would have the wine, and you'd pour out the wine and use it. So now you've got this old, empty wineskin that's been stretched to the max. Well, if you were foolish enough to put new grape juice into that wineskin and seal it up, that grape juice would start to ferment and it would start to gas, and what would happen to that wineskin? It's been stretched to its limit, so it's going to burst, it's going to tear, and the grape juice, the wine, is going to be lost on the ground, and the wineskin's going to be no good. So you're going to lose both. That's the problem. No one puts new wine in old wineskins because the fermenting process will destroy both. So his point here is that he's not putting new teaching into the old wineskin of Pharisaic Judaism. So that is basically the three points of his response. And you know, this is a warning that Jesus' teaching is new. It isn't to fit into the old traditions. It won't fit into the old traditions. And this warning went unheeded by the Ebionites of the second century. Now, in the second century, there were two segments of the Messianic Jewish congregations, two segments of the Messianic community. The Nazarenes, they were the Orthodox segment, and the Ebionites. Now, the Ebionites rejected the authority of the Apostle Paul. They rejected the divinity of Yeshua. They made the Mosaic Law mandatory. And as soon as they did that, they were welcomed back into the fold by the rabbis, because they really were no different from the rabbis. And so the Ebionites basically disappeared from history. The Nazarenes accepted the authority of the Apostle Paul. They accepted the fact that the Mosaic Law was no longer obligatory, and they accepted the deity of Yeshua, and they continued right on down to today. So the Ebionites disappeared from the Messianic community, 1,800 years ago. But you know, many aspects of the Messianic community today are making the same error. So I want to just let you know about Messianic congregations today. Some of them are very good, but many of them, unfortunately, follow what they call the Torah observant movement, and they're basically committing the Ebionite error all over again. They have a problem with the Apostle Paul. They want the Mosaic Law to be mandatory, and they have a problem with the deity of Yeshua. So if you go to a Messianic congregation, check their doctrine. Check their doctrine. Find out where they stand on those three issues. If they are not Orthodox, they are committing the Ebionite error all over again. Okay? Now, in verse 39, the very last verse of the section, we come across a response. And no one, after drinking old wine, wishes for new, for he says the old is good enough. Well, this is a difficult verse to interpret, and there are two possible interpretations we could take. You think it over and decide which one is the best for yourself. One is positive and one is negative. First of all, he could be speaking about their attitude. He could be saying that they will desire the old and reject the new. They'll desire the Mishnah and reject the Messiah. He could be saying that. Or, on the other hand, it's possible that he's comparing Mosaic Judaism, you know, biblical Judaism, to Pharisaic Judaism, and saying, if one drinks deeply of Moses, you will say that Moses is better than the Mishnah. So basically, he may be trying to get them back to the foundation, back to Moses. But in either case, Yeshua is not accepting the authority of the Mishnah. He's not accepting the authority of the traditions of the oral law. So keep that in mind. That's the key factor. And that's what will be covered in sections 57 through 59. The Messiah's authority over the Sabbath. Who has authority over the Sabbath, the Mishnah or the Messiah? And it's what the Mishnah has to say about the Sabbath will be the conflict. The conflict will not be over what the Bible has to say about the Sabbath, but what the Mishnah has to say about the Sabbath. You see, to the Sabbath commandments, the two Sabbath commandments, Oral law added some 1,500 traditional laws. Okay? An additional 1,500 laws were added to the commands, remember the Sabbath and keep the Sabbath. In addition, the rabbis began to personify the Sabbath. And it comes down even to today. If you go into the synagogue, say, example, in an Arab Shabbat service, we'll sing a song called Lecha Dodi on Shabbat. It's a song welcoming Queen Sabbath. Come, my beloved. Lecha Dodi, come, my beloved. So it's a personification of the Sabbath. In fact, in rabbinic theology, Israel was created for honoring the Sabbath. And so the Pharisaic additions made the Sabbath very, very complex. Now, page 25... I have a quote there from Encyclopedia Judaica dealing with the exaltation of the Sabbath. And I have it up on the screen here from the Jewish Encyclopedia. The article is the Sabbath, but the subsection is exaltation of the Sabbath. And here's what Encyclopedia Judaica says. Jewish Encyclopedia. The observance of the Sabbath in all its details is highly extolled in the rabbinic Haggadah. If all Israel observes two Sabbaths, or even one Sabbath, in all their details, it will immediately be redeemed from exile. The Sabbath is a costly present given by God to Israel. The pleasures of the Sabbath are 1/60th of the delights of the world to come. He who honors the Sabbath with the preparation of delightful things will receive all that his heart desires. His portion will be limitless. His sins will be forgiven. He who eats of the three prescribed meals on the Sabbath will be saved from the troubles of the Messianic age, from the judgment of Gehenna, and from the wars of Gog and Magog. Pretty good deal, huh? Just follow the Shabbat. He who had the Israelites observe the first Shabbat in all its details, no nation or tongue could have prevailed against them. That, my friends, is the exaltation of Shabbat. And it is viewed that way down to today in the Orthodox community.
How many laws would you say?
1,500 were added to the Mosaic Commandments. 1,500. All righty, with all this background, turn to page 26 in your outline. And we'll come to section 57, a lame man healed in Jerusalem on the Sabbath. Now, section 57 is at the bottom of page 57 in your harmony, and we'll read verse 1, the very bottom of the page. John alone covers this incident, so we have one column there. John 5:1. After these things, there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. All right, the conflict is now going to begin with the Mishnah over the issue of the Sabbath. This will be the third of seven signs. This man healed will be the third of John's seven signs. Now, the feast, as best we can determine, is a Passover feast. And one of the hints that it is the Passover feast comes in the fact that many manuscripts read the feast. The definite article is very clearly there. And the feast was normally considered to be Passover. So it is probably Passover, the second of his ministry. So that means 1.5 years has now elapsed. 1.5 years of preaching up in the Galilee. Now we're at the highlighted word purpose in the middle of the page. And let's read John chapter 5, verses 2 through 9. Turn the page over to page 58, and we'll read verses 2 through 9. All right, everybody there, okay? Now there is in Jerusalem by the sheep gate a pool, which is called in Hebrew Bethesda, having five porticos. In these lay a multitude of those who are sick, blind, lame, and withered, waiting for the moving of the waters. For an angel of the Lord went down at certain seasons into the pool and stirred up the water. Whoever then first, after the stirring up of the water, stepped in was made well from whatever disease with which he was afflicted. And a certain man was there, who had been 38 years in his sickness. When Jesus saw him lying there and knew that he had already been a long time in that condition, he said to him, "Do you wish to get well?" The sick man answered him, "Sir, I have no man to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up, but while I am coming, another steps down before me." Jesus said to him, "Arise, take up your pallet, and walk." And immediately the man became well and took up his pallet and began to walk. And notice the final sentence. Now it was the Sabbath on that day. All right, so we have healing on the Sabbath in the Pool of Bethesda. So let's get a little bit of a... orientation to the Pool of Bethesda, its location, and the archaeological discoveries at the Pool of Bethesda. Here is a map of the city of Jerusalem. You can see the upper city, the lower city, and then in the north, the Bethesda suburb, and just north of the Temple Mount, there's the Pool of Bethesda, where it's located. Now we're going to move over to the right and go up onto the Mount of Olives. And now we're on the Mount of Olives. We're overlooking the city from the east, looking west. And we can see the Valley of Hinnom to the south, the Kidron Valley below us, the temple below us, and then just to the north of the temple, the Pool of Bethesda. All right, does that all make sense to you? I'm trying to orient you to the city. All right, now this is a picture of the model of first century Jerusalem that used to be at the Holy Land Hotel. When it was on the grounds of the Holy Land Hotel, they wouldn't let you take pictures of it. But now they've moved it to the Israel Museum, and now you can shoot all kinds of pictures of it. And so I think that's a great, great thing to have happened. So here we're standing basically on the Mount of Olives, and we're looking at the temple to the left. And then to the north of the temple on the right is the pools of Bethesda, right there, the buildings with the red tile roof. Coming in a little closer, again, there's the pools of Bethesda with the five covered porticos, and there's a close-up of the way archaeologists feel these pools looked in the first century. Now, you have this diagram, a page or two on in your outline, and this diagram shows you the five porticos. You have the portico to the north, number one, and then to the east, number two, to the south, number three, to the west, number four, and then the center portico, number five. And that, of course, is where the people who were sick would shelter themselves as they waited for the troubling of the waters in the two pools. Now here, of course, again, is another view of the pools of Bethesda. How do they look today? This is the way they looked in the first century, as best we can determine. But if you go to Jerusalem today, this is what you find. Now this is the current street level of Jerusalem. This is what you see on the street level. But you'll notice that the pools are 30 to 40 feet down under rubble. And there's been a lot of rubble and construction on top of the pools of Bethesda. And so you have to look down quite deep into the excavations to see the actual pools themselves. And you can see the archways and supports and all that that have been put in place over the last 2,000 years. Now here I'm looking down directly into the pools, and you can see the steps that go down into the pools. You can see they disappear at the top of the page into the new building, and to the right and to the left they disappear into the rubble. But you can see it's a typical construction of the day. You have about four steps going down and then a platform. Then four steps going down and another platform. So you can see a couple of the platforms here in this part of the excavation. It's not exactly in the best shape in the world. It'd be nice if they could excavate more of it and really give us a good look at the pools. But it's very obvious that they're there. We know where the corners are. And we have a good fix on the pools of Bethesda today. So I just want you to use your imagination a little bit. And we don't know if this is the area where the paralytic was, but just imagine him up on the top platform and the water down a couple of layers down below, and the water gets stirred up, and he has to climb down these stairs and to get into that water. And he can't do it on his own. He has to be helped. And it just takes too much time to get down into the pools. Yes?
What do you think caused the stirring? Back then they thought an angel of the Lord, but what caused that stirring? Did that create a mineral?
Well, no. If it says the angel of the Lord, my answer is the angel of the Lord. Okay? Okay? I don't go with the naturalistic explanations if there's a clear explanation in the context. You know, so.
They're still doing it in France at Lourdes.
Well, yeah, that kind of thing still occurs, yeah.
Yeah, and you can't get in the water.
Why?
Well, okay. Because of the number of people.
Because of the number of people,
and
yeah.
And it's also called, the framework of that is Our Lady of Fatima.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
is Middle Eastern. That's from their Muslim heritage
right.
in Spain.
Yeah.
So they brought that over, and she's worshipped, but they recognize that she's Muslim.
Yeah, exactly.
Brutal.
So anyway, I would just stick with the text that says an angel did it.
How many times a day? There's no
doesn't say.
Doesn't say. Okay.
Just on occasion, yes.
Was it a place where there was real springs coming up, or was the water brought in?
No, I don't think there were springs there. I'd have to research out exactly how the water was brought in there.
What's with the moss there, like a little dam?
Yeah. If you look back, you can see water at the bottom there. Still water in the, there's a water table there of some sort. Okay. All right, so that's where this event occurred, the healing of the paralytic on the Sabbath, followed by instruction to pick up your bed and walk. Why did Jesus do that? The instruction, he knew the instruction would raise the issue that it raises and force the leaders to come to a decision. Now, obviously, this paralytic was carrying a burden. I mean, that's obvious. But he was also breaking more traditional laws than that. It's not quite that simple. It's much more complex than that. He also broke Mishnah Shabbat 1:1, which is moving something out of a private area to a public area. We'll look at that in just a moment. Remember that those 39 categories of labor, remember number 39, transferring from a domain to a domain? That's the one we're going to look at, a category of labor. All right, the I have some quotes regarding this on page 26, so I'll read them out of my notes here. You can read along. I want to introduce you here to the intricacies of Mishnah and pill-pull reasoning. I want to introduce you to some of the rabbinic quibbling that goes on, even to today. All right. Carrying out and bringing in anything from one place to another is said to be work and one of the principal works, and therefore forbid by the law, which says, thou shalt not do any work. And one of the traditions of the elders is this: whoever carries anything out, that is, on the Sabbath day, whether in his right hand or in his left or in his bosom or on his shoulder, is guilty, for so carried the Kohathites. Remember, the tribe of Kohath was given the job of carrying some of the tabernacle implements and etc. So how can you carry it? Your right hand, your left hand, in front of you, on your shoulder. You know, if you carry anything, that's what the Kohathites did, and so if you do it, you're guilty. And particularly it is said that he that rolls up a bed of the braziers or the tinkerers on the Sabbath day is bound to a sin offering. So don't roll up your bed. Don't roll up your mat and walk with it, okay? Or you're guilty of a sin offering. All right. Now remember, back in lesson 4, page 26, I directed your attention to category of labor number 39, transferring from a domain to a domain. It was considered a principal work. We just saw that a moment ago. And so it was dissected by rabbinic logic. And this is on page 27. Mishnah Shabbat 1:1. Let me just introduce you to rabbinic reasoning. Okay, is everybody there? The types of transfers on the Sabbath are two, which are in reality four within, and two, which are in reality four outside. How is this so? Well, I'll tell you how it's so. Let's imagine a situation. A poor man is standing outside and the householder is inside. So you got a poor man on the outside, the householder in his house. One, if the poor man extended his hand inside and placed an object into the householder's hand, okay, here it is. I stick my hand through the door, I place it in the householder's hand. Or if he took an object from it and brought that object out, if I reach in, grab this object, and take it out, the poor man is liable for a sin offering, and the householder is exempt. Householder didn't do anything, only the poor man. Two, if the householder extended his hand outside and placed an object into the poor man's hand, here it comes, into my hand, or if he took an object out of the poor man's hand and brought it inside, the householder is liable and the poor man is exempt. So in the first instance, the poor man transferred from domain to domain, and in the second instance, the householder transferred from domain to domain. Got it? Okay. Three, if the poor man extended his hand inside and the householder took an object from it or placed an object into it, and he, the poor man, brought that object out, both are exempt. So in their thinking, neither of them transferred the object. So they're both exempt. They didn't break the law. Number four, if the householder extended his hand outside and the poor man took an object from it or placed an object into it, and he, the householder, brought that object in, both are exempt. So if they did it that way, they didn't break the traditional law, they didn't break the Mishnah. Okay? See what they're thinking? See how they're doing it here? They're trying to dissect this into every possible instance.
Oh, that's underhanded.
That's underhanded. Good one. Everybody cheer, Roger, this time. Yay. All right. So the paralytic we read about. The paralytic we have just read about was guilty of principle one or two. He carried his mat. He rolled up his mat, and he carried it out of one domain into the public domain. And when he got home, he would break the law again by going from the public domain into the private domain. So this poor guy was building up sin offerings on top of sin offerings. He's guilty for three offerings now. Okay? All right. So if he had just remained in the private area and handed his pallet to somebody outside, he would have avoided, they would have both been exempt. That's number three or number four. All right. You see how this thinking goes? Okay. Page 28, lesson four, is an article on the Pool of Bethesda and that drawing I was telling you about. So let's go to section 58, and we'll finish up on section 58, top of page 29. So this is an effort to kill Jesus for breaking the Sabbath and saying he was equal with God. John chapter 5, verses 10 through 18. We're in the middle of page 58 in your harmony. Okay, everybody there? All right, well, let's start with verses 10 through 13. Therefore, the Jews were saying to him, to the paralytic, saying to him who was cured, "It's the Shabbat. It's not permissible for you to carry your pallet." But he answered them, "He who made me well was the one who said to me, 'Take up your pallet and walk.'" And they asked him, "Who is this man who said to you, 'Take up your pallet and walk'?" But he who was healed did not know who it was, for Jesus had slipped away while there was a crowd in that place. All right. So, we have violations in their eyes. He's working on the Sabbath, carrying a burden. He's moving it from domain to domain. Verses 14 through 18. Afterward, Jesus found him in the temple and said to him, "Behold, you have become well. Do not sin anymore, so that nothing worse may befall you." The man went away and told the Jews that it was Jesus who made him well. And for this reason, the Jews were persecuting Jesus, because he was doing these things on Shabbat. And he answered them, "My Father is working until now, and I myself am working." And for this cause, therefore, the Jews were seeking all the more to kill him, because he was not only breaking the Sabbath, but also was calling God his own Father, making himself equal with God. All right, so they have a couple of accusations against this guy. He healed on the Sabbath, so he broke the Sabbath, and he makes himself equal with God. Now, I want you to notice the difference between Jewish thinking and Gentile thinking. You know, many people say that Jesus was a good man, but Jesus never claimed to be God. And it's true. You will not find the statement in the New Testament, "I am God," uttered by Jesus. Only 21st century Westerners demand that kind of a statement, okay? To require that kind of a statement from Yeshua is to view him from a Gentile, 21st century Gentile perspective, not a first century Eastern perspective. From a Jewish perspective, he claimed to be God incarnate very clearly. When he said that God was his Father, he was uttering the claim, "I am God," from a Jewish perspective, and those who heard him understood his claim. Verse 18, making himself equal with God. They understood it very clearly. Don't let anybody get away with that silly comment that Jesus was a good man, but he never claimed to be God. Now, in regard to that comment, if somebody makes that comment, they better think through the implications of their comment. And I want you to challenge them if they ever come up with that. So If someone says to you, Jesus was a good man but never claimed to be God, there are only three options that we have, and I'm sure you're all familiar with this. Jesus is either a liar because he's not God, or he's a lunatic because he's not God, or he is God, he's telling the truth. And those options require us to ask a question, and the answer we give determines a result and a practical response. So we have to ask the question to our friends, can a good man be a liar? And the answer is no, because that leads to deception. And the proper response is to loathe him. Right? Like my L's? Okay. So a good man cannot be a liar. Can a good man be a lunatic? And the answer is no, because that leads to disaster. If he's a lunatic, you need to lock him up. So if Jesus was a liar, he's not a good man. If he's a lunatic, he's not a good man. Can a good man be the Lord? Yes, if he's telling the truth. And if he is the Lord, then that gives us proper direction and we should make him your leader. That's the implications of this kind of a statement. So don't let anybody get away with that, because with Jesus, there's no fence walking. There's no silly statements allowed that he was a good man, but that he couldn't possibly be God. He's either a liar and a lunatic, which will lead to deception and disaster, or he is the Lord, which will give direction to your life. Does that make sense?
Yes.
You will get this chart next week. The morning class wanted it. I didn't have time to run it off. And so you'll get that, and I'll also give you the Mishnaic quote on how the Mishnah came down to the great synagogue, too. Someone also asked for that. Yes?
When Nicodemus came to Jesus and said, you are a good man, and he said, no one is good but God, what do you
mean? Yeah, it was a Richard von Euler. It wasn't Nicodemus. He's forcing him to think through what the implications of his statement. Okay, only God is good. Are you calling me God? We'll talk about that when we get there. Okay. All right, let me pray, and then I'll turn you guys loose. Father, again, we want to thank you for your word, and thank you for this challenge that came at the end of the lesson tonight. Is Jesus a good man who never claimed to be God, or is Jesus a good man who is God? And Lord, we know the answer to that, and we know the affirmation of his divinity found throughout the Bible, both in the Hebrew Scriptures and in the New Covenant. And so, Lord, help us to orient our lives around the truth that, yes, if Jesus is a good man, then we need to make him our leader. We need to obey him. We need to make him preeminent in our lives. So, Lord, help us to grow in that conviction and in that attitude, and help us to challenge those that give us challenges like this silly statement that Jesus never claimed to be God. Help us to stand firm and say, you know, have you thought through the implications of that? Do you know what the biblical data is? And bring them face to face with the truth. And help us to do this to the Jew first, but also with the Greek. And we ask this in Yeshua's name. Amen. All righty. We'll see you guys next week.